I'll call the tax committee to order. My apologies, and I thank you for being here. I was talking to the Commissioner of Revenue right now, who was telling me what a great job both of you are going to do. So I think what just a couple words is there's two unsession bills here, and one is the governor's, and one is one that I did where I attempted to, I didn't do it really in the sense that I asked Nonpartisan House Research to take a look at everything and see what they could find that maybe we as a committee would be willing to unsession. So that's what the two are. My intent would be we would just have one bill as the unsession bill as part of the omnibus tax bill. And so we'd work off the governor's bill would be how I'd like to do it. And I should say Representative Davids, I know you were unable to be there. I think you sent Representative Torkelson in your spot when the House and Senate, both majority and minority, met with the Commissioner of Revenue and staff. And so everybody's tried to give a little input to this. I think folks are hoping this is similar to yesterday, nonpartisan stuff. If anything's controversial, I was just mentioning the Commissioner, and I hope you will share with folks in Revenue and the Governor that, you know, my intent would be to not pursue it if it's going to be a problem for folks. So this really should be kind of vanilla, I would hope. So with that, I hope we can just go through them like you did so well before and just tell us what's in them, and then we'll just take questions and then lay them over. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and move whichever one you'd prefer to start with. I assume the governor's, and that is, we don't have a quorum, so we're not moving anything. So please start with whichever bill, or we'll start with your bill, and then we'll have Mr. Michael do the bill that House Research did. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Starr. I'm the Senior Manager for Tax Policy at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm joined here with Paul Cummings, our legislative liaison at the department, and we'll be walking through House File 2578. As you know, the governor asked that departments work on developing unsession bills this session that remove obsolete, duplicate, and unnecessary statutes. He specifically asked that agency heads and legislative staff begin making lists, checking them twice, and working with any legislators, other public officials, and citizens who wish to spearhead these reforms. So here we are. Throughout the interim, we've worked with agency staff and collaborated with legislative staff and members to develop this unsession approach. And we really want to thank Chair Lynn Chesky and House staff for working hard with us in creating what we believe is a bill that does just what it was intended to do, to remove obsolete, duplicative, and unnecessary statutes. The bill begins with Chapter 16D, which is our chapter on the collecting of other state agency debts. Sections 1, 2, and 3 remove references to debt qualification plans. We now enter into service agreements to collect other agency debt. Section 4 removes a reference to Minnesota Management and Budget. The department now contracts directly with collection agencies, making the reference to MNB unnecessary. Section 5 and 6, there's a variety of cleanup here. Notice requirements starting at line 3.25 are moved to line 3.16 so that all notice requirements are in the same section. An obsolete reference to MNB is removed, and language regarding collection costs paid by agencies is removed, as these costs are now paid by the department. On page 4, section 7 and 8, remove references to what was known as the enterprise. There is no longer a separate unit within the department that collects only non-tax debt, making these references to the enterprise unnecessary.
On page 5 of the bill, sections 9 and 10, eliminates obsolete date-specific references to property tax base amounts in 1931 and 1933 under a program allowing counties to apply for state takeover of state lands for reforestation.
Section 11 allows sellers of dry cleaning solvents to file and pay the dry cleaning fee at the same time they pay sales tax. This reduces the number of forms that these taxpayers fill out and file.
On page 7, section 12 eliminates an obsolete reference to the tax on money and credits. This tax has not been imposed since the 1940s and was repealed in 1979. Section 13 removes superfluous language related to the State Board of Equalization. Section 14 strikes paragraphs 2 and 5 and amends paragraphs 1 and 4 to ensure the State Board of Equalization retains the same powers and responsibilities. On line 9.5, it also removes an obsolete reference to magnetic tape. Section 15 removes unnecessary language. class rates are made clear in other parts of statute. This section of statute provides the authorization for utilities to be separate classes of property.
Section 16 removes another reference to the enterprise, which was already discussed. Section 17 removes reference to the biotech and health sciences zone program, which is repealed in the repealer section. This is effective January 1st, 2016, which is when the program sunsets under current law. Section 18 removes a requirement that the commissioner create an electronic notification system for sales and use tax by December 2009. This requirement was met and is now passed. Section 19 removes language on line 11.29 that conflicts with the $50 flat fee imposed on line 11.30 for entering into a payment agreement with the department.
Section 20 removes superfluous language describing personal property, which is already described under the overarching statement, all real and personal property is taxable. Sections 21, 46, 52, 53, 56, and 64 remove obsolete references to telegraphs and outdated technology. The first reference, as you can see, is on line 12.16. Section 22 removes a cross-reference to a statute that is proposed to be repealed. 272.02 deals with personal property tax exemptions and can be found on page 2R of the repealer. Section 23 eliminates a cross-reference to a subdivision repealed in the repealer section. The repealer is in 3R of the repealer section and deals with the date-specific personal property tax exemption for an electric generation facility in Itasca County. Plans to construct were canceled in 2002. Section 24 removes outdated date-specific language for past wind energy production tax distributions. Section 25 is the first section that references the Aggregate Resource Preservation Law. This program was intended to limit property taxes for land containing commercial aggregate deposits. It has never been used and is obsolete as all counties with otherwise qualifying property have opted out. This was originally passed in 2008. Sections 26 and 82 remove obsolete salary scales and compensation for county assessors. This deals with only county assessors themselves. This was originally passed in 1967, and as you can see, the salary ranges are out of date. Section 27 deals with the assessment, liability, and recording of personal property related to school districts. There will be many statutes that we'll talk about today that dictate to county assessors and auditors and treasurers how to record assessments or judgments. Since technology has made those recording mechanisms obsolete, we are removing the methodologies from statute while continuing to keep the mandate to assess or apply judgments. So this is the first example of many. As you can see, it's saying by writing the number of the school district opposite the assessment column on the page, these are obsolete methodologies as we're using computers. Section 28 removes a reference to when accredited assessors may value income-producing property. Since this is past the 1995 assessment, this is no longer needed. Section 29 contains instructions from the legislature for the Commissioner of Revenue to develop guidelines for valuing golf courses and other types of properties. And there are specific instructions to the commissioner on when to send those instructions out. We're well past that time, and we have instructions out. So this bill removes those date-specific instructions. Section 30, I'm going to have you move to page 22 of the bill. As discussed before, this section removes Class 2E, which is a special classification for land containing aggregate deposits. There's no property in this class anywhere in the state, so it is being removed. Section 30, and this is also dealing with the cross-reference change, Section 31. Section 32 on line 24.5, it updates the reference for when descriptions of exempt property must be listed. And so we're updating that reference here from 1926 to 2010, which will make it easier to calculate. And then on line 24.6, it removes a reference to the paper assessment books, as we discussed before. Section 33, if you go to page 26 of the bill, there are more paper assessment book references. Mm-hmm. Section 34 removes some superfluous language. Section 35, for sections 35 and 36, we currently use net tax capacity, which is taxable market value times the class rate. Net tax capacity was created in 1988 and was effective for taxes payable in 1990. The transitional gross tax capacity measure was the primary basis for taxes payable in 1989. There were was local tax base adjustments at that time, and hence we have things now like disparity reduction aid. Section 37 deals with special levies. Section 37 removes paragraphs 14 and 20. These are special levy authorizations for date-specific provisions. So as you can see on page 29 of the bill, we have in paragraph 14, we're talking about the court takeover costs. And then in paragraph 20 on page 30, we have the I-35W bridge collapse, both of which are date-specific and no longer needed. Section 38 and 39 make cross-reference changes because of the special levy removals. Section 40 removes obsolete date-specific provisions that have passed and are no longer applicable. Sections 41, 42, 43, 47, 49, and 51 deal with paper recording requirements for judgment books. We had mostly talked about assessment books. While the requirements have not changed for recording these judgments, we propose that the methodology of this paper assessment be removed. On page 35, section 44 eliminates obsolete references to a reference to 1941 statutes and replaces it with the current statutory reference. Sections 45 and 48 removes obsolete date-specific references. This statute references public sales of property against which there is a tax judgment. If you look on page 37, section 46, we have another telegraph reference on line 37.20. Section 47 is dealing with these paper judgment books. Section 48, we're taking out some date-specific language on 39.18, and there's a telegraph reference on 39.12. Section 49, again, deals with the paper judgment books. Section 50 removes an obsolete redemption period for the Loring Park neighborhood, beginning after 1991 but before 1996. Since those dates have passed, this is no longer needed. Section 51, again, we're talking about paper judgment books. And Section 52 is another reference to the telegraph on 41.24. Section 53 is another telegraph reference, 41.31. Section 54 removes obsolete date-specific language. Section 55 is again removing obsolete date-specific language, stating that the statute applies to all repurchase applications after July 1st, 1985. We are past 1985. Section 56 is another telegraph reference on line 43.3. Section 57 on page 43 of the bill removes obsolete references to session law. We have on section 58 removes reference to obsolete deed tax documentary stamps, but it preserves the overall duty of the county treasurer. We were hoping to bring in an example of what these documentary stamps look like, but we do not have one today, so we hope to share that in the future, maybe for the omnibus bill.
Section 59 deals with estimated tax payments and removes language that is also found in section 289A.25 subdivision 4. Section 60 removes references to foreign sales corporations. These entities no longer exist under federal law. Section 61 and 62 remove obsolete language related to ACRES, or Accelerated Cost Recovery System. All assets placed in service under ACRES have been completely depreciated, making these modifications obsolete. That moves us to section 63 on page 48 of the bill. Section 63 removes language regarding the biotech zones. Section 64 removes a reference to telegraph companies on line 50.9. Section 65, which is on page 50 of the bill, and Section 66 repeals language regarding accounting periods and methods. Because we start with federal taxable income, taxpayers use the same methods that they use for federal purposes. Section 67 removes obsolete language for a number of items, including acres depreciation, biotech zones, and intangible drilling costs. Section 68 on page 53 strikes language regarding the biotech zones. Section 69 removes references to net operating losses incurred in taxable years prior to 1987. Section 70 removes a phrase on line 55.4 that was made obsolete last session by legislative changes to the sales factor for corporate franchise tax apportionment purposes. On page 57 of the bill, Section 71 removes a cross-reference to a subdivision repealed in the repealer section. This has to do with the obsolete acres depreciation language. Section 72 on line 58.29 strikes the phrase Turkish bath. A Turkish bath is a steam bath, which is already listed on the same line. Moving to page 61, section 73, on line 64.11, we're removing a cross-reference to a subdivision that was repealed last session. On page 64, section 74 strikes language specific to past periods that phased in the current 5% contribution requirement found on line 64.21. Section 75 and 76 remove sales tax refund provisions for the construction of the Long Lake Conservation Center. Construction is now complete. Section 77 on page 67 deletes language that limited the sales tax refunds for construction of the Central Corridor. These periods, fiscal years 2010 and 2011, and not until after June 30, 2009, have passed. Section 78 on line 68.27 removes deposit of revenues percentages related to past periods, fiscal years 2001, 2002, and 2003. On page 69, section 79, we're also removing deposit of revenue percentages for past periods, 2007 through 2010 and up to June 30th, 2011. On section 80, we're striking a list of information required on a license application for tobacco distributors and subjobbers, leaving the form to be prescribed by the commissioner. Section 81 strikes the phased-in tax rate for insurers who sell life insurance that applied to a past period, identifying the current rate of 1.5% on line 71.6.
Section 82, as we discussed before, it references obsolete assessor compensation salary provisions. Section 83 removes irrelevant language that was erroneously left in the bill that was enacted in 2013. This bill was later amended, and this language inadvertently remained in from an earlier version of the bill. Section 84 eliminates reference to compact development districts. The authority to establish these districts expired in 2012 and apparently was never used. Section 85 eliminates obsolete TIF language related to administrative expenses. This removes language that applied to districts that requested certification from 1979 to 1982. Section 86 clarifies that the special TIF authority for biotech zones can be used until those districts expire. Section 87 eliminates an obsolete reference to the tax on money and credits. It has not been imposed since the 1940s and was repealed in 1979. Section 88 removes outdated provisions from 2009 County Program Aid to Pine County. This has already been paid and is no longer in effect. Section 89 removes obsolete references to the road accident factor, which is no longer used for calculating local government aid. And it's too bad. Just a few years ago, this would have been a longer discussion. Section 90 and 91 removes cross-references to CPA distributions that are obsolete and date-specific. We are now going to move to the repealer of this bill, and so then we'll be walking through the appendix.
Starting on page 1R, the definitions in 16D.02, these are simply definitions that are no longer used. 16D.11, this is the repealer because the rate for collection costs is now provided in subdivision 7. 270C.131, this removes a quarterly sales tax report from the department to Explore Minnesota that Explore Minnesota no longer wants. We utilize broader disclosure language authorized in Chapter 270B to provide Explore Minnesota with the information they do want. 270C.53, this provision allows the department to forgive tax debt in exchange for community service. To our knowledge, it's never been utilized, and we believe it's obsolete.
Section 270C.991 deals with the property tax working group. Their work was completed in 2013. This was part of the recommendations from the Legislative Commission on Planning and Fiscal Policies, and was part of the reduction of the Executive Advisory Council. For 272.02, dealing with exempt property, Subdivision 1 repeals redundant language. Each section of this part of statute specifically states it is exempt. Subdivision 1A, Section 272.025 already states that it is applicable to Section 272.02. With all of these that are being removed, there are no taxpayers that will be impacted. All of these provisions are date specific. All were intended to be built, but they were never built. And all would have to come before the legislature again if they wanted this tax exemption. So the Subdivision 48 is a waste tire cogeneration facility in Fillmore County. Subdivision 51 is an electric generation facility that was planned for Waseca County. Subdivision 53 is an electric generation facility that was planned for Minneapolis. Subdivision 67 was an electric generation facility planned for Dakota County. Subdivision 72 was an electric generation facility planned for Waseca County. Section 82 was a biomass electric generation facility planned for Minneapolis. Section 272.027 repeals personal property tax exemption for public utility project in Itasca County. Plans to construct this project, as I talked about later, were canceled in 2002. 272.031 is unnecessary language related to record keeping. 273.015 is talking about making sure the tax is computed to the even numbered cent. This is to make sure that there are two property tax payments throughout the year. And at one time, this was needed in order to make sure that those could be kept in two different pockets, two different sections. Now, counties go to the nearest dollar. 273.03, this states a basic tenet of statutory interpretation and therefore is superfluous. 273.075 deals with instructional courses for assessors. This was a one-time appropriation in 1971. The University of Minnesota does not offer those courses anymore, and the Department of Revenue doesn't do this anymore, so this can be removed. 273.1115 is the Aggregate Resource Preservation Property Tax Law. As we talked about before, this was a program limiting property taxes for land containing aggregate deposits. Program is obsolete, as all counties with otherwise qualifying property have opted out. 273.1383 dealt with the 1997 flood loss replacement aid. This impacted assessment years 1998, 1999, and 2000, and provided appropriations in fiscal years 2000, 2001, and 2002. And I can go through the counties if that would be helpful, but otherwise, 273.1386 was another obsolete flood aid for 2004, reduced local aid to affected cities. that received flood aid in 2004 and 2006. And again, I can talk about those counties impacted, but it is for a past period. 273.80 on 7R was the distressed homestead reinvestment exemption. To qualify, you needed to meet the eligibility requirements before May 1st of 2003. You could qualify as 5 years after initially qualifying. So, in effect, the last time you could qualify was 2008. Therefore, it is not in use. On 8R, section 275.77 dealt with some a suspension of maintenance of effort requirements. This was something Representative Maury Lanning worked on. He had a working group on mandate relief and came up with this proposal to provide a temporary mandate and maintenance of effort relief. It is date specific and is obsolete. 279.32 is an obsolete provision relating to lands with delinquent tax liability repurchased before 1936, which allowed a county to take a certain action before 1985 to list such property as delinquent for 1942. 281.173 and 281.174 statutes remain in effect, but the effective dates have now been passed. So really these subdivisions for the effective dates are obsolete. 281.328 are obsolete provisions validating state assignment certificates issued before 1972. 282.10 is an obsolete provision authorizing reimbursement to the purchaser of tax forfeited property made before 1940 that are invalidated by the court. 282.23 is an obsolete provision providing the sales of property that was forfeited to the state in 1926 and 27 shall be conducted in the usual manner, and that has now since passed. 287.20 deals with the definition of documentary stamps, and again, these are not used for collecting mortgage and deed. And 287.27, they're tax meter machines that were used to affix these deed documentary stamps. Both the stamps and machines are obsolete.
289.856, again, repeals some language regarding biotech zones. 290.01 subdivision 4B starts with repealing a definition for mutual property and casualty insurance companies. This is a definition that's no longer used in Chapter 290 and was last used prior to 2001. Subdivision 19E removes more obsolete language regarding acres depreciation. And on page 10R at the very bottom, subdivision 20E, this repeals duplicate modifications in computing taxable income of an estate. Minnesota allows this subtraction if elected federally by the estate by starting with federal taxable income. On page 11R, 290.06 is repealing language regarding the biotech zones. 290.0674, this repeals a prohibition against claiming this credit, the Minnesota Education Credit, against the individual AMT. Because of changes to the AMT, this prohibition does not affect any taxpayers. 290.33, this was introduced in the 1930s and is a section that explains how to administer a tax imposed in the middle of a calendar year. Because our law changes have appropriate effective dates, this section is no longer relied on. 290C.02 and 290C.06 remove obsolete language regarding the SFIA program. And 291.41 through 291.47 on page 13R all have to do with a uniform law that allowed states to elect to arbitrate with one another over the jurisdiction of taxing an estate for estate tax purposes. To our knowledge, these sections were never used in Minnesota. Page 13R, 295.52 repeals a temporary rate reduction for Minnesota Care. And 297A.68 repeals language regarding the biotech zones. On page 14R, 297A.71 This repeals language regarding sales tax construction exemptions for projects that are complete or were never built. Section 297F.08 repeals obsolete language in our cigarette tax area dealing with railroad sleeping car distributors. There are no such distributors today.
Sleeping car.
On the top of page 15R, 297H.10, this repeals a failure to file penalty because subdivision 1 of this section is actually what currently imposes that failure to file penalty.
On page 15R of section 469.174 is the definition of compact development TIF districts, which expired in 2012. 469.175 deals with the sunset of compact development districts. 469.176 permitted the use of increments for compact development districts. 469.1764 dealt with pre-1982 TIF districts, but not the pre-79 districts. The districts referenced have all been decertified. Any remaining increments would be required to be returned, from what I understand. 469.177, distribution of TIF revenues generated by referendum levies to school districts. This provision is obsolete since all of these operating referenda levies are now spread on a market value, which does not generate increment.
At the bottom of page 16R, starting with 469.330 and continuing through page 23R, this repeals the biotech zone.
On page 23R, 477A.0124, dealing with county program aid, this repeal, it's a provision of providing county program aid in 2004 and 2011, 2012. All of these are one-time distributions. They're date-specific. Section 505.173 repeals obsolete authority for local governments to correct defects in plats. This authority expired in 1953.
On page 25R, at the top of the page, this repeals a rule related to individual net operating losses, which is obsolete as a result of numerous law changes since the rule's promulgation in the 1970s. The next rule, 8007.0200, this is obsolete because taxpayers must use the same accounting methods as used for federal purposes.
Rule 8100.0800, these were changes made to the way utilities were assessed in the mid-2000s. This rule gave direction about the phase-in. This phase-in is now complete, and the rule is therefore obsolete.
At the bottom of page 26R, Rule 8130.7500, this repeals an obsolete subpart in the sales tax area concerning microfilm reproduction of records. This is an outdated technology no longer used by taxpayers. On the next page, florists and nurseries, we're repealing an outdated rule regarding the sourcing of telegraphic orders by florists and nurseries, as this became obsolete with the 2011 law change. And finally, the rest of the rules repealed here have become obsolete regarding the registration of aircraft, because this is now handled by the Office of Aeronautics at the Department of Transportation. And that is the end of the bill.
Nicely done. Thank you. And we have a couple questions. Representative Davids is first, but if we can we get the minutes moved? We have a quorum now, and it's February 27th and March 14th, but we need to amend the March 14th top of the minutes to add the year 2014, if that's okay with folks. Can anyone make that motion?
Yeah.
Okay, so Representative Hansen moves the minutes for February 27th and March 14th with the March 14th minutes amended to add the year 2014. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The minutes are adopted, and we're now going to move the bill, Governor's tax on session bill before us. So that is, could someone move House File 2578 to be before the committee? So Representative Hansen moves House File 2578. It's before us, and now we'll go to questions. I just want to repeat for people who are coming in. So this is the governor's work. There's been bipartisan eyes looking at it. House Research did one for me over the fall and winter. and I think when we go to theirs, we'll just hear what's additional. And we'll just have Mr. Michael tell the committee what House Research found an additional. And the concept here would be there would be one bill. It would all go into the omnibus tax bill. And anything that's objectionable to folks, we'll just take out because it's not intended for anything to be controversial. So Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I was looking at Section 81 regarding the life insurance premium tax. And after I looked at it further, I kind of figured out what's going on. So I just want to make sure we're not messing with the retaliatory taxes from foreign life companies, but I think you're good. I think we're good there.
So either if you want to comment. Mr. Michael, you want to double, triple check on retaliatory taxes for Representative Davids?
Madam Chair, I don't think it's going to trigger any.
Okay.
That's what I always look at there. And it has nothing to do with streamlined sales tax. I don't think.
Okay. So if someone finds differently later, we'll bring that back up again. Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My ears perked up on that tire burning thing that we were going through. That's not what the question was about. I was going to ask about on page 11, the Sustainable Forestry Incentive Act. And you're proposing eliminating a classification, not the act itself.
Right. Mr. Cummings, Ms. Starr, yes, that's correct.
Yes.
And were you hoping for something there, Representative Hansen?
Madam Chair, I just take the opportunity that we had a legislative audit report during the interim that I think would be really good for the committee to hear, and you know, you might see a bill about repealing that program, which would give you an opportunity to have the auditor come in and present on that.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Carlson, then Liebling. Representative Carlson.
Madam Chair, question of the department. As we go through this and you see things that go back years and years and years, raises the question in my mind, you know, we've had various bills through the years that go through not only in the area of taxes but state departments and so on with repealers. And I don't want to necessarily focus on the past and why a lot of these things weren't repealed years ago, but how do you see the process in the department as we move forward so that some future legislative body isn't looking at a list like this with outdated statutes or where things are no longer applicable because whatever it was designed for is no longer taking place? That might be a question I'd ask of other departments and other committees as well, but what do you see down the road to make sure we don't have this kind of a list?
Mr. Cummings or Ms. Starr, thoughts?
Madam Chair, Representative, I know in our normal technical bill review process that a lot of those ideas come to the department because a taxpayer has a question or somebody's raised a concern that has alerted us to the obsolete language. In this process, we had people in every floor of the department reading our statutes from cover to cover, and it certainly alerted us to maybe what we can do in the future to catch more of these in our annual technical review process.
And Madam Chair, that's the point that I'm trying to make, is that if it were done a bit more frequently and I didn't know what kind of activities getting us to this point took place. And I'm talking about a variety of governors, a variety of administrations that this kind of thing just didn't, for whatever reason, happen. But so that you don't have everybody on every floor having to do an extensive review like this again, if it's done more periodically, it would be a lot easier process for everyone. That's my main point. They don't need to respond to that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm listening to these, you know, most of them I don't have a problem with, and I'm not even sure I have a problem with the ones I'm going to bring up, but I'm just kind of wondering, as a matter of philosophy, if it's a good idea to just go ahead and repeal things that give the department authority to do things, even if that authority hasn't been used, or, you know, you don't see yourself using that authority, because if I'm just kind of wondering why we would do that unless it's stuff that is you know, is the space in the statute book so valuable that you want to give up authority just to kind of clean house on something? So what I'm looking at is the repealing of the law authorizing arbitration of disputes between or among states. You know, it's enacted in 1951, never been used. You know, the fact that it's never been used doesn't convince me. I guess I'd kind of like to know, what do you do then? You know, that's kind of more the thing. If we're going to take away authority to do that, what replaces it? So that's just one of them. And then there was another one that sort of struck me. The one about repealing the authority to abate the liability of a taxpayer and let them perform uncompensated public service. And I get that that might be expensive to apply on an ongoing basis. It's, it takes a lot more to do that. But it just makes me wonder, wouldn't there be some situation where that might be appropriate, and yet we're repealing the ability to do it in the appropriate case? So you kind of respond to why we're going that direction.
Please, thanks.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm glad you asked about the estate tax arbitration language. That's one thing I know something about. What I can tell you is there was a time at which all of the states had what was called a pickup tax for estate tax purposes, and this was a uniform law that I believe most, if not all, states passed, so that if there was ever a dispute about which state should collect the pickup, what was called the pickup tax, we'd have a mechanism to arbitrate that kind of dispute. But at this point in time, there are only 15 jurisdictions that have an estate tax, and I believe only three of those, although I'm pulling from the back of my memory, it's something around three, still maintain this uniform language. To my knowledge, we've never used it. No one has ever asked us to arbitrate that kind of dispute, and we certainly wouldn't expect it now with such few states relying on that uniform law. Does that answer your question?
Ms. Starr, can I just jump in with, so is that provision just for the estate tax, the pickup issue, or is it written broadly for any arbitration among states? I mean, one thing that I think of is Governor Pawlenty working, and then Governor Dayton as well. Different revenue commissioners have worked on, I see former Commissioner Innes right here, and he worked on this, and now Commissioner Franz is, you know, Wisconsin and the reciprocity issue. So is that piece of legislation, was it written just for the estate tax that you're appealing, or all issues for arbitration?
Madam Chair, it's only for the estate tax.
Representative Liedling.
Thanks, Madam Chair, and I had that question too. Thank you for clarifying that, but you know, even so, this is something that, you know, I sort of don't care if it's never been used. The question is, could there be any scenario where you would want to use it? And you're saying it's unlikely, but here we're just repealing something that's just kind of sitting there causing no harm. So if it's unlikely, but it could be used, I don't see the point of repealing it. Do you want to respond?
Further.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess all I can say is that's a fair point, but I think it's not just unlikely, it seems almost impossible for this provision.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I was just thinking about how for the more recent entrees that we're repealing, it must have been a trip down memory lane for our staff and the Department of Revenue and remembering the battles to get them in, and I thought it was a nice cautionary tale for all of us that our work may soon enough face a repeal not too long after we've fought viciously to get it into the books. But it was just that comment. I just thought, oh, I remember that and that one too. Yeah. The battles die away, and all that's left is the ashes.
I want to ask if there's public testimony on this legislation. Okay, if not, what I'd like to do is just lay this over for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And if you could just stay right there, we'll just go right to the next one, because we're going to have Mr. Michael talk about other things House research might have found. And again, the committee should just, you know, think about what do they want to put in or not in. And again, the intent would be if there's things that are objectionable, we just don't want to do them if they're going to create a headache. So I'll go ahead and move House about 2107 before the committee and ask Mr. Michael to walk through that summary telling us what's an additional item that House Research found. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, as the chair said, I'll just try to highlight the items that are in House File 2107 that are not in the department's bill. And before doing that, I'll try to explain why there are differences so that you can understand what's going on. The chair requested the House Research staff to go through and find items before the department, or while at the same time the department was going through this same exercise. During the pre-introduction phase, the chair introduced this bill, which was the product of that effort. The department has reviewed these provisions, and some of them they took and put into their bill, and some of them they chose not to. So the ones I'm going to go over are the ones that they chose not to do that. I'll try to point out why, to the extent that I understand it, and you can decide whether some of these may have merit or not. The other thing I will say, in our exercise, we took a little bit broader mandate in looking for things that could be streamlined or eliminated than what the department did, and that explains some of the reasons why some of these provisions are not included in the department bill. And to the extent that you want to be cautious, you probably won't want to include them either. And in some cases, after we found out the effects of them, we probably would not have included them either. And with that, I'll first start on page 2 with section 3, and this has a companion provision in the repealer, which repeals section 127A.48, subdivision 7. This is a provision that involves calculation of the adjusted net tax capacity, both for school aid purposes and for local government aid purposes. There's a valuation limit that says if your value increases by more than 19%, then there's a separate calculation that goes on. We, in including the repeal of this, had thought that this affected only just a handful of taxing districts and involved very small amounts of money. After this was in the bill, we've done some more research, and that was true in the past, but the huge run-up in farm values has caused this to apply to more taxing districts. In the last school district run that we have suggests that it would affect, I think, 1.6 million in levy, and so this is probably not a good candidate to include if you don't want to start changing around school district levies, and that's why the department did not include it. The next provision that I'd like to highlight relates to all of the changes, and this is on page 3, section 5, and then it flows throughout all of the bill related to the biosciences. You heard the department staff testify with the bioscience zone. They're repealing that prospectively. Essentially, they're not repealing it until 2016. And so if you look at the effective date in their bill, it's delayed, whereas in the House File 2107, it's effective more or less immediately. So that's a key difference. And this is something I don't have feelings or recommendations on most of this stuff, but this is one thing that I actually would really recommend that you consider doing something different than what the department recommended on two bases. One, I think you should either do what's in the chair's bill and make it effective immediately, or if you're going to not do that, I would delete these changes from the bill. And the reason for that is because of the way the reviser publishes the statutes. If you make these changes, if you repeal the bioscience zone effective in 2016, what will happen is that the reviser will publish the current version of the statutes with these changes in it, but then in a note below that, if you look at a copy of the statute, under each statute there's a note that provides the history. Because this has a delayed effective date, in tiny type they will reprint the existing version of the statute. So what you would do by doing this is you will increase the size of the statute substantially. And the reason they do that is because they want users to be able to see what the law is. And the law would be not this. It would be what the old statute was. And so I don't think it makes sense to do that. The reason why we included it in the chair's bill was because the last time the legislature ever allocated tax reductions under this program was for fiscal 2005. So for the last 9 years, there have been no tax reductions under this. It has two more years to run. So in theory, the next legislature or the current legislature could allocate tax reductions for this. But I don't recall any governor or legislator proposing that. And so that's why we put it in the bill to repeal it immediately. So that's a long story about that one provision. But it flows through to many, and it's like 15 pages of the statutes, and there are multiple cross-references. So this would, you know, really would have a fairly substantial effect. The next provision that I would like to turn to is on page 11 of the bill, and it's also section 11. This is the special levies provision. This provision is in the department's bill, but they, and keep in mind that the levy limits are not in effect now. So this is just the template that is in the statutes. If the legislature decides to reenact levy limits, how will they be calculated? In doing that, we went through and eliminated some more minor special levies than what the department did. The department got rid of just purely obsolete special levies that you could never levy again. But there are some things that are relatively, that are very small, and the differences I will point out to you are on page 12, the stricken clause 10, and on page 13, which is the levy for pension costs that became effective after 2001. That looks like it's obsolete, but it would make all of those pension levies special levies as opposed to being in the base. That was done back in 2001 because there was a big change in the pension law that year. We felt that it's better just to build it into the base and have it grow if levy limits are reimposed. On page 13, there's also one for lake improvement districts and for the Humane Society. Both of those are very small levies, and they would be in the base. So they would get the levy that they levied in the year the levy limits were imposed, but they would not have to calculate it as a special levy. The department, by contrast, only eliminated items that were truly obsolete, that could no longer be levied. So that was, again, just sort of a difference in philosophy about the way we did it. The next one to look at, and there aren't a lot, so this isn't going to take a huge more amount more of your time. If you turn to page 21, section 21, for some reason all of these pages and sections are lining up. This is the apportionment formula under the corporate franchise tax for essentially regular corporations. Then on the next page, in page 22, it's for financial institutions. As I suspect many of you know, we've gone to single sales, and so now we're at 100% sales. What we did in the chair's bill is to strike all of the phase-in language that shows the history of what percentages of sales we were at back in tax year 2008, 2009, etc. The department chose not to do that. I'm not sure about that. I think they want the convenience of having the history in the statute, but they can talk to that. The next difference is on page 23. The department, in doing the old sales tax exemptions, struck out the ones that were totally obsolete because they had dates in them that required them to be completed by a specific date. There's one there on lines 17 and 18 that relates to a meat processing facility, which is in the city of St. Charles, that was not obsolete under that provision. However, based on what we know, this facility will not be built, and so we regarded this as being obsolete because it's just not going to get built and never will be used, and so we thought we should take it out of the statute, whereas the department said, no, this is something that technically somebody in the city of St. Charles could decide to build, and so they could qualify for it. So that's that's another difference. The next difference is on page 25 of the bill, section 27. And 28, there's a number of changes that we had in the bill that were in the taconite and minerals tax area, all of which are just relate to obsolete provisions. The department, because the IRRRB is putting together its own unsession bill, is going to have those there, and so that's why it's not in the DOR bill. I won't go over those. I think they are actually going to have, the IRRRB is going to have more provisions than what we found in the tax stuff. The next difference, which relates to the aggregate tax, is in section 29, and that is the gravel tax. And what we did was, on that section, we struck, there are references to a whole bunch of individual counties, and then it says all counties have the authority to oppose the gravel tax. We thought that was kind of silly, and we should just say all counties have the authority and not list Pope, Stearns, Benton, etc. I don't think there's a substantive effect to that. I'm not sure why the department didn't include that. The next provision, section 30, is also different, and this is a substantive provision that could be controversial, and that's why it was dropped. This, in combination with a repealer provision, would have extended the authority to all towns and counties that don't impose the gravel tax to be able to impose a gravel tax. Under current law, there's just a handful of counties in St. Louis County and Otter Tail County that can do that. This would, if you were to include this, that would be controversial because there's a bunch of towns that may want to in other counties that want to impose that gravel tax, and that's why the department did not put the provision in their bill. The next difference is in section 31, and this change, right under current law, cities of the second, third, and fourth class, if they have estimated market values of less than $41 million, can accept gifts. What this would do would be to allow any city of the second, third, and fourth class to accept gifts. These are not just any gifts, though, they're gift annuities. This is a provision that, because of that property tax value limit, is something we've looked at. We didn't understand why every second, third, and fourth class city ought not to have the authority to accept gifts, and so we struck that sort of property tax value limitation. The department viewed that as a substantive change, and so therefore did not include it in their bill. That moves us on to Pat's pointing out to me that I skipped. Oh, yes, sorry. I'll get back to that. On page 10, section 10, there was a change in the disparity reduction aid that essentially limited or eliminated fairly complex calculation so that it doesn't have to be recalculated with class rates. Again, this was one of these things that we thought it would have very little tax effect, but would make the computations for the affected tax administrators much easier. Again, because I think the department, because they considered that to be a substantive change, did not include it. I don't think it will have material effects on actual property taxes. Turning to the repealer on page 1R, the first difference is in section 272.02, subdivision 43, this biomass facility. I don't recall which city this project was for, but again, this is sort of like the St. Charles situation. This provision does not have an expiration date, but this was a planned facility which we know was not constructed, and nobody's planning to construct it, and so we thought it made sense to take it out of the statute, even though it doesn't have a date that says you have to build it by this to get it. The next The next difference is on 3R, and that's in the middle, the repeal of 273.1103. Back in the early 70s, 1971 to be exact, the legislature went from essentially what was called full and true value to assessed value. Full and true value, which had been used for decades before that, was essentially one-third of what ultimately became estimated market value. And so this provision was written into law when that 1971 change was made to say that if you've got a charter limit or a special law limit or something like that, you still have to essentially divide it by three to calculate it. We thought we could repeal that because we're now 40 years plus beyond that, and we assume that most of those limits have been restated and so forth. And even if they haven't been, this will not be harmful because it will increase the limit rather than reduce it. The department, you know, correctly probably viewed this as a substantive change and did not put it in their provision. There's another provision that they had in their original draft that would have had more serious effects on local calculation of local government's limits, and local governments told them to take that out. But this provision, I don't think, would have any harm, and you could decide to include it. I think I may be... on page 6R, the repeal of 273.1398, subdivision 4B. This is an obsolete provision in the disparity reduction aid. This was deleted from the DOR bill, and I think I was talking to Mr. Cummings before, and I think we've concluded, I think this was a mistake. It should have been left in the DOR bill, so we should probably put that back in the bill that goes in the omnibus bill. Section 290.06, subdivision 27. This is a corporate franchise tax credit for tax paid to another state. This is a credit that was enacted for an individual taxpayer in the 1990s. Nobody's used it since then. That's why we recommended it to be included. The Chamber of Commerce and the Business Partnership said they were uncomfortable with that, and the department took it out, and for that reason, you probably don't want to include it. Even though this is rarely used, it provides them some assurance that if they get into one of these disputes with another state, that Minnesota will sort of bail them out. Section 290.9191 on 9R is also a single sales thing. This is a special apportionment formula for mail order businesses. They'll be covered by general law now, and so that's why we recommended repealing it. I think that covers everything that I need to cover. Oh, I'm sorry. Pat points out I forgot to do the sales tax. These are the more interesting parts here. That's all relative. It's all relative, and none of this is very interesting at all. I realize that. Okay, so on page 11R, 297A.69, subdivision 7. This is so short, we'll just actually read it. Poultry feed is exempt if the poultry is raised for human consumption. This is a provision that does not relate to farmers, so let's keep that straight. Farm purchases for farm production are exempt. So if a farmer is raising eggs, they buy their feed tax exempt. This relates to people who have backyard chickens, and they're allowed to purchase their feed tax exempt, but if you read the language, it's only tax exempt if they're raising them to eat them. And we were assuming that most of these people with backyard chickens are not raising them to slaughter and eat them, but rather they're raising them for eggs or because they like chickens. And so because we felt that there were likely people who were buying poultry feed for eggs or for their chicken friends as opposed to meat, that this was probably not being correctly applied and should be repealed, or alternatively, you could expand it so that it would apply to the folks who have backyard chickens that they're doing for eggs and for pets.
French.
And then the actual way that the law is being probably applied would be consistent with the way it's written. And the Department of Revenue has put a revenue estimate on this and said that it would raise $160,000 if you repeal it. So that's the story on that.
Madam Chair? First of all, those are my constituents you're talking about. Mr. Michael.
No.
as well as Representative Kahn. Has chickens. So we're successfully moving in a tax reform fashion to expanding the sales tax base by doing this. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Davney, yes, if you were to repeal this, this would have a minuscule effect on the tax base. And I will say, and I was just sharing with Ms. Dalton before the meeting, that when I was a young boy, I had a pet chicken.
But you ate yours.
Name?
But
name?
What it tastes like.
Amazing. There's now about six people on the world on chickens. But before we go to those people, we're going to ask Ms. Dalton to comment on this matter of feeding your chickens.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, this was actually an exemption that was put in as to deal with one person's audit. And actually, you'll hear the same thing for the next
Jim's
one.
But
as I said, as it relates to the backyard chickens, the reality is this isn't a very workable exemption right now, because it says it has to be, the poultry has to be for human consumption. So if you're raising chickens for eggs, you should be paying sales tax on your feed. And we're guessing, based on the estimate, that people probably aren't. So either we should clarify the law so we aren't going to have somebody get audited down the line that they are using this tax-exempt feed for something that they shouldn't be using it for, or we should not provide this exemption. Now, having said that, I will also say this is the only exemption we have for raising food for personal consumption. You pay sales tax on your vegetable seeds. If you are doing honeybees in your backyard, you pay for all of the things that you buy for the honeybees. So this is, as I said, and this wasn't really based on an individual being audited. This was based on a feed seller being audited.
Madam Chair, you pay sales tax on the bees.
Ms. Dalton.
Yes.
Okay.
Before
we go out of these questions, can we just let Mr. Michael finish? He was just about done with that bill. I think he had like another sentence. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, moving on from chickens to wine. also in the House bill is sacramental wine. It can be any color, I think. Section 297A.70, subdivision 9, the House bill has a repealer for this special exemption for sacramental wine. Now, this is not, would not result in imposing tax when the Archdiocese purchases wine for communion or any other exempt entity. They are exempt based on their status as an exempt entity. This situation arose again, as Pat suggests, with the chicken case, out of an audit of an individual taxpayer where there was an individual taxpayer who purchased, because this individual was a clergy, was able to purchase sacramental wine tax exempt on behalf of the entity, and then was reselling it to someone else for use as sacramental wine. And so this applies in instances where the wine is being resold to an individual. And so again, this is one of those sort of anomalous provisions that we thought maybe in a streamlining type situation. But again, the Revenue Department didn't include it because they had a different sort of view of what this bill should be, that it would should be more narrowly focused on the obsolete, obscure, you know, no, don't change policy kind of a thing. So those are that's it. We're done.
Okay. And so we have some questions. I just want to reiterate that we're just going to ask everybody to work with House Research or the department if you have individual concerns, or Mr. Rubis or Ms. Locke, however you're comfortable, to get anything controversial that we don't like in these things out, and we'll put them all in one bill as part of the omnibus tax bill. So that's the intent. And can I just ask, is there anyone from the public who wants to testify on this one? Didn't think so. Thank you. Okay. So Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say I support Streamline, and I like Mr. Michael's recommendation, but urban agriculture has gone far beyond the tomato plants. And while some do it as pets and egg sources, I believe with the diverse immigrant communities in our city that we probably do have people who are doing it as a food source for their families. And so I think we need to just not assume that that's never been done.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And following up on Representative Loeffler, I think you could fill this room with the backyard chicken advocates if you wanted. That would take up a while. So there are the tour de coupe I think in Representative Paymar's district, the Egg and I are the. There's a whole business devoted to urban agriculture that sells everything related to urban agriculture. So if your threshold is controversy, I would take that one out because I think it could actually generate quite a bit.
I think it's dying real quick here. I remember the Bloomington City Council hearings on who can have chickens in their backyards. They were some of the most packed hearings. Representative Liebling.
Well, thanks, Madam Chair. Also on the chickens and the wine line of questions. So I was going to ask how this thing could be applied. I mean, you're just going to go in and tell your person you're buying your feed from that I'm going to eat my chickens, therefore I don't have to pay the tax. And that seems really strange. But my second part of that is the sacramental wine thing. And I was going to ask about that even before you brought that up because I noticed it. And I'm not really sure, like, in what situation, if Mr. Michael could just be a little more, give an example of who now would get an exemption that wouldn't get it if we remove this and the sacramental wine thing.
Mr. Michael? And Ms. Dalton, too. Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, what this would do, it would take away the current exemption that exists when you're essentially an entity reselling sacramental wine to an individual. So what would occur is that it's only, you know, purchases by the churches or the synagogues, temples, etc., that would be able to purchase sacramental wine tax exempt if they were reselling it to individuals. Now, I think the one thing that may give you pause about that is if there are some religions where sacramental wine is used not in the setting of the institution but in the home, I think that may be the situation where this in theory could apply, where you would say then the individual, I guess you get into all sorts of interesting questions about compliance, and are you thinking back to Prohibition era about where there was a heck of a lot of sacramental wine, obviously, that was not really sacramental wine. But our tax is probably not that high enough to generate that kind of evasion. And I will say, let me make an editorial comment on the chickens. I think if you want to keep the chickens in, that it would probably be sensible to expand that so that it does apply to people who are buying it to raise eggs and who have chickens as pets, so that, as you're saying, that it's when you go into Fleet Farm and buy, I don't even know if they sell poultry feed, but when you go to the feed store and buy poultry feed, that the seller can know, okay, poultry feed is exempt as opposed to G, how are you using your chickens as being the defining criterion?
Ms. Dalton? Further? No. Okay, we've got Benson and Schoen, and then we're going to adjourn. Representative Benson.
Madam Chair, I was just going to add some levity, but maybe not. Other than to say that I would be opposed to any tax breaks for roosters who terrorize six-year-olds like one did for me. And secondly, if we give breaks to the Archdiocese, I want to make sure the Episcopalians and Lutherans also get the break.
Thank you. Representative Schoen.
Madam Chair, this may be for Mr. Michael. So, again, on the University of Michael and Dalton, the annuity issue that you talked about, would this be like what they do at churches then? I mean, it's a form of a gift of money or a donation? And
Mr. Michael.
Madam Chair.
I mean, so basically we're expanding something for everybody, or I guess I was more curious about if it was on that same lines. And is there any other donations that any city can't accept? So, I mean, Representative Davids could fund, like, the entire operating budget of the city of Newport. I mean,
I could.
Yeah. And so he can give that in cash now, right? And that would be legal, but he couldn't necessarily in an annuity. And is there any other way that somebody, that Representative Davids, couldn't give money to any other form?
Mr. Michael, how can Representative Davids fund all of our local governments for us?
That's a great question.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Schoen, that you're right. That essentially what this is doing is it's saying that larger cities, ones that, you know, other than the first class cities, if you're, you know, based on that value break, you can't get into this arrangement. It is exactly what you're talking about, where nonprofits will approach you and say, wouldn't you like to give a gift annuity, particularly to, you know, older folks who want to leave some money but want the income from it? And so what that change would do is that would just open it up to all cities to accept those kinds of gift annuities. You know, and again, I think I didn't go back and look and see when that $41 million limit was put in there, but my guess is if you adjusted that for inflation, you know, it just didn't make sense to me anyway to have a limit like that.
Representative Schoen, Representative Davids.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Michael, when you say gift annuity, is there a distinction between a gift annuity and just an annuity, or is it an annuity that's given as a gift? Is that a gift annuity?
Madam Chair, Representative Davids, the way these things work is that you're a charity and I'm an individual that wants to give money to you, but I also want a stream of income over time. So what you do is you say, I say to you, I will give you $1 million, and then you will pay me an annuity. But that annuity doesn't, a normal annuity would pay you back your entire $1 million based on actuarial tables. Well, this sets aside some residual to be given to the charity, to the entity. When I die, you, the charity, will get that residual. But in the meantime, while I'm alive, you will pay me an income based on some assumed interest rate. And the IRS has a set of valuation tables that determines how much I can take as a charitable contribution for giving you that future interest, that when I die, you get the residual. And you, as the charity, decide what kind of interest you want to pay me, which determines, under those IRS tables, how much I can deduct as a charitable contribution.
So, Madam Chair, Mr. Michael, you're setting up a SIA, and upon death, the balance goes to the charity.
Correct. Right. And it's routinely done as a fundraising thing by lots of charities.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is one other repealer that we forgot to mention that's in our bill that is not in the department bill, and that is on page 25R, and it is a repeal of a sales tax for the city of Garrison that was authorized in 1993. This is the only local sales tax that was ever authorized that didn't require that the voters hold the referendum by a date certain, and so this is the only open one. Garrison has actually started coming forward thinking about doing another one, because this one the project that this was originally authorized for is never happening in the city. So if Garrison is going to come in for a local sales tax, it wants to use a local sales tax for another project, they're going to have to come in anyhow. So it'd be just good to get this law off the books since they can't use it anymore.